It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Could early intervention have prevented a third of the homicides in Pittsburgh last year? According to a report by the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health's Community Violence Prevention Project, more than 30% of the homicides in Pittsburgh last year were likely related to peer violence, not gang activity, and are the type of crime most readily prevented by early intervention. Joining us now in Studio A to discuss how early intervention can play a role in reducing homicides is Stephen Albert, chairman of the Department of Behavioral and Community Health Sciences at Pitt Public Health. Stephen Albert, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Also with us is Richard Garland, visiting instructor in the Department of Behavioral and Community Health Sciences and co-author of the report. Richard Garland, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
And you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is essspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at essspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Again, your questions and comments at 412-246-2002. Gentlemen, let's begin by having you define peer violence. With so many homicides in Pittsburgh related to peer violence, explain what it is. Richard Garland.
You know, one of the things everybody would always think that is gang-related. Many Pittsburgh neighborhoods are, right now in Pittsburgh, they look at them as different gangs. We see in the work that we've done that many of the homicides that occurred in 2012, the individuals knew each other and they were from the same neighborhood or they were from the same community. That's how we define peer violence, that it's not gang related, but it was right in that community or that neighborhood that a guy was killed by somebody that he really knew.
Somebody that he knew. And so why is this happening between people who are young people who are familiar with each other?
Money, economics, money, drugs, arguments, girls. Simple as that.
And the age range we're talking about here is what?
14 to 35.
14 to 35.
Yeah.
And
this is different than gang activity.
Yes, Stephen, go ahead.
It's a little different than gang activity where there's control over a territory where there might be fenced stolen goods or maybe a little more organized drug traffic where there is a history and a name and an insignia and a tattoo perhaps, a little more of a leadership. What we're talking about is a little less structured, more in the moment maybe, of people who in another situation would either settle their argument without a gun or might not have the argument. Something precipitates it. And it escalates from there.
These are age-old disagreements and arguments, and we're three men sitting here of similar middle age, I'm guessing. And did we settle things this way when we were kids, or what is different about this now?
You know, the impulsivity of kids. You know how impulsive kids are,
sure.
And the access to a gun. And the type of drugs they're using. The heroin has made a huge comeback. Crack is still here. We talk about other gateway drugs. Now we're talking about mollies. Mollies is something that you don't hear much about, is that kids mixing stuff together and they taking them. You have no idea what the outcome of that's going to be. Ecstasy is still here, you know.
So is this all drug related, or is there more to it than that?
There's more to it than that. I think because of some of the issues that some of these kids might have, ADHD. You know, they might be on some type of meds and mixing these meds. You know, I think that drugs and alcohol, from my vantage point, is at the foundation of every problem that we have in America.
But, Stephen, what I was getting at earlier is there a societal difference?
Well, let me address a couple of things. Our homicide reviews, organized so well by Tegan O'Malley, who's with us today, we were able to get, I think, a little fuller picture of the homicides. So, for example, two-thirds of the victims had some kind of criminal history. They've had contact with criminal justice in one way or another. But also about half of them have had human services of some sort, either in school or in childhood or through these prior contacts with the jail and probation system. so you're dealing with a group, an at-risk population, and then you add to it drugs and you add to it the easy accessibility of guns in these communities, and you have an explosive mix. That's what's different about, I think, today maybe compared to when we were younger.
In addition to the homicides, where peer violence was a possible motive, what else did the research show?
We looked at the closing of housing communities affect the violence in some of the areas. School closing, did the young people or the adult come from gang-related or drug-related families? You know, we looked at all those things. We went back into the community and we got with people who was in that circle of the victim's friends, colleagues, what have you. And, you know, those are particular questions that we ask.
These are the public health drivers of some of the violence. So we think it's not just criminal activities, not just personalities. If you close a low-income housing authority and mix up subsidized housing and you mix up neighborhoods, you could precipitate violence. If you close a school and mix up people, you can precipitate violence. People who return from prison to communities can introduce a wild card element that can precipitate violence. Mm-hmm. So there are bigger factors of environmental and policy dimensions that affect violence in these neighborhoods.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about the Pitt Public Health Community Violence Prevention Project with Stephen Albert, Chairman of the Department of Behavioral and Community Health Sciences at Pitt Public Health, and Richard Garland, Visiting Instructor in the Department of Behavioral and Community Health Sciences and the co-author of the report. 412-246-2002, the number to call if you'd like to take part in the conversation. 412-246-2002, the email address esspgh@wesa.fm. You can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Let's go to Julie from North Hills. Julie, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I will try to be as brief as possible. Just this past weekend, I was in the Lawrenceville area, and I witnessed a young woman, and I feel she was being abusive to her small child, about 3 years old, grabbing the child, shoving him back in the stroller, grabbing the crying child, shoving him back in the stroller. And I called the police because I wanted them to witness this. I gave them a very accurate and exact description of where I was. And I even told the operator I was willing to stay and speak with the police, gave them the exact location of my car. Unfortunately, they got on the bus. The police didn't show up. And how could I have followed up on this? I think that this is how violence starts at a very early level. And I was really concerned, and I cried for this little boy who was crying in the stroller, and he was upset. What could I expect? How could I follow up on that situation?
Well, you raised two very interesting points and two very good questions, Julie. One is what can a citizen who witnesses something like this, how can they appropriately intervene? But also, what is the impact of something like this? If a parent is perhaps not equipped to deal with a child who's having typical problem of a toddler, how much does that contribute to the problem in society? Let's start with that question, Richard or Stephen.
Well, this is a tough one. I think we've all seen something like this, and maybe we've all been tempted to shove our children back into the strollers when we are losing it too. I've wondered about this myself, and this might be a case where the police also wouldn't be very well equipped to deal with this.
What do you think, Richard? We've all seen this, haven't we?
You can say something to that parent. You right. can say, not saying nothing, it could go either way, because you could say something to the parent and the parent could, the first thing that, this is my child, I can do what I want with my child. You have nothing to do with it. Or, you could be the common thing to help that parent deal with that child a little bit better by, you know, saying something.
What would you suggest that Julie do in this situation, or anybody who's in a situation like that? But
she could have, you know, excuse me, ma'am, you know, I'm feeling really, you know, some kind of way about the way you're treating your child. Could you do it another way? You know, something like that, you know, just to approach, you know, I know you're mad. You know, is there something that, you know, we could ease that, you know, but a lot of times, many people don't say anything. We don't say anything. We watch things go on, and, you know, as long as nothing is said, then it means it's okay.
Do you think that this has something to do with the behavior later in life that a young person might exhibit, violent behavior?
Yeah. You know, I think it has all the remnants for it, yeah.
412-246-2002 if you'd like to join the conversation. Richard Garland, you say that we need programs that will get these young men safely through the killing years. What are the killing years?
14 to 25. I mean, it's been that way nationally all over the country.
Those are the years when we are less – when young men – we're talking about young men here.
Yes.
Young men are less equipped to deal with their feelings of and violent emotions, angry
based feelings. On – we can talk about economics. We can talk about the community in which they come from. We talked about human services, being involved in the human service system. We talked about being involved in the criminal justice system. All those factors, you know, I think – relate to young men. I mean, young men, most of the young men that we've dealt with, we see that they've had a prison record. They had some information or dealt with human services in at some point in their life. You know, what are they lacking? School, a job. So I think that many of the programs that are coming up now that they're doing in the school districts, different school districts, community-based organizations, where they're trying to address young men and women at an early age of issues that they might be having. That's one of the ways we can curtail some of the violence. For me, education is very important for all young people. So if we can get them a better education, and if we can also address some of the issues, the anger issues that they might have, some of the, you know, we have a lot of kids that have been born addicted to drugs and stuff like that. We still need to really address some of their issues that might come out to be mental health issues, even drug and alcohol issues. And then employment. Employment and training for me. Employment and training is key to stopping a lot of the violence. For years, I used to work at YouthWorks, and we used to get jobs for young men. By and large, it was always the young ladies who really mature quicker than young men do, and they were the shining stars because they wanted jobs. You know, women are more mature. You know, they mature at an early age. But guys, we're immature. If we're in the drugs and alcohol, that's even worse.
We hear that there is less and less resources for dealing with mental health issues in all aspects of society. Stephen, how much does that impact the situation that we're dealing with here?
Okay, it's a great question, and we're very interested on this mental health violence connection, something we don't know as much about that we should. You know, I think you read every day about shootings in schools, and these are obviously, for the most part, people who have unaddressed mental health illnesses. often they have some contact with the mental health system, but clearly they fall through the cracks. If these folks can have easy access to guns, you have the same explosive mix. I think what we're talking about here are not necessarily psychotic breaks where people are going to kill randomly. We're talking about something a little different. They have other kinds of mental health problems. It's the substance abuse. It's the depression. It's the anxiety that comes with a ripping and running lifestyle. That's a little different. But still, a greater engagement with mental health is probably a key element in in the getting the violence problem under control, and I don't think we have the right programs yet for that.
412-246-2002 if you'd like to join the conversation with our guests, Stephen Albert, Chairman of the Department of Behavioral and Community Health Sciences at Pitt Public Health, and Richard Garland, Visiting Instructor of the Department of Behavioral and Community Health Sciences and co-author of this report. The Pitt Violence Prevention Project is modeled after a program developed by the National Network of Hospital-Based Violence Intervention Programs. Explain, if you would, how they work.
Well, let me give a little background. So we really have two different efforts going on. One are the homicide reviews, which we just released our 2012 report, and we're already well along in 2013. Unfortunately, in the county, we've already had close to 80 homicides at this point, and Pittsburgh seems to be on track for its usual – I mean, the county seems to be on track for its usual 100 or so homicides, split roughly city and county. So that's one effort, and we've learned quite a bit from that. And for the first time, I think we've brought together all the players who need to review each of these homicides. You may know that right now the city has a, where the county health department is required to do a child death review. We feel the same needs to be done for homicides, and we're spearheading that and working with our health department to try to build that element. That's going from the death backward. We now want to do something a little different, Paul, that you mentioned, is to start with the gunshot wound going forward. And we are working with our four level one trauma services in hospitals in the county to identify people who show up in the trauma service with a gunshot wound, make contact there, meet family, meet the relevant risk group there, and follow these folks back into their home communities and do a more extensive outreach with some of it will be case management. Some will be seeing if these folks are willing to introduce us to their social network and identify other people at risk of either being shot or doing some shooting as a follow-up, and see if we can intervene at that point. So between working backward from the deaths and working forward from the wounded, we feel we'll get a better purchase on the whole problem.
Have you already started doing some of that?
Richard, why don't you?
Yeah,
Go ahead.
Yeah, we have started in the hospitals, Presby, the four major, Presby, Allegheny General, Mercy, and Children's. But Presby is the one that really led the charge. Dr. Alan Murdoch was the one who said to us, you know what, we just prolong in life. We just keep patching the same guy up, you know, so we want to stop recidivism. So we're working with the social workers, everybody, the hospital buy-in. We got hospital buy-in at the top level. One of the things is this hospital-based intervention program is a national program. It's originated in Oakland, California. A group called Youth Alive is actually working with other sites in the United States that's doing hospital-based intervention. What happens is when a guy comes in, he's shot, social worker will ask them, you know, we have some folks that, you know, could help you, you know, after you get rehabilitated, to get back into society and hopefully stop you from getting shot again. You know, so when we do show up at the hospital, one of the first things we want to, questions that I'm going to ask them is, you know what, which one of your friends is most likely to go after who shot you? You know, we need to shut this down now. You know, and usually, you know, a lot of times they'll tell us what's up. And then there's other things, you know, he might need a job. He might need a high school diploma. You know, we do with working with the Department of Human Services and all our other partners, we can start lining them up for services to get them on a productive track.
And are you now or will you be tracking the results of some of
this? Yes.
It'd be very interesting to see how it all works out. We have time to take one more phone call from, I believe it's Tamir from Pittsburgh. I hope I said your name right. Tamir, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yes, it's Tamir, yes. I have a basic comment that I believe that we still haven't really addressed, not only your panelists, but the basic problem in this country, the remnants of slavery and this institutionalized racism wherein our community, our children are not being properly nurtured, they're not being properly educated. So by the time our kids, and particularly the young males who are targeted, by the time they are in the fifth and sixth grade, they are useless for society, basically. They're not educated. They don't have no idea what to do. The family can't help them. And so you go through the system. Then you get to the age where they're 25, 24, 20s, and they have no idea what to do, how to make it, how to survive in this country. So what do? They do negative activities. All right, any comments?
Yeah, my comment will be, you know, whose issue is that? We're not looking for the system to address that issue. You know, it's just the same way that me and you came up. We came up with our parents teaching us the right and the wrong thing and giving us a history of where we came from. You know, I think with the inception of heroin and crack and all the other drugs, we stopped doing that as a people. I think, racism is alive and well, you know, here. But the same way when we talk about education, we used to, you know, our folks used to educate us. We're not doing that. We're not doing that as a community of educating our young men and women about, you know, what it is to be a African-American male. So, I mean, those are some of the things that we have to do. You know, I'm not expecting the system to do it. You know, we can talk about racism. We can talk about classism. We can talk about all the isms, you know, but I think let me say this is my personal opinion. From my vantage point, we have to be the ones to take the bull by the horn. We can't expect nobody else to teach our kids. We have to teach our children the right and the wrong, you know, what their history is. History is really important in the lives of every ethnic group that's here. We have to do a better job with that. That's just my personal opinion.
Gentlemen, unfortunately, we've come to time, but Richard Garland, visiting instructor in the Department of Behavioral and Community Health Services, thank you so much for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us is the chairman of the Department of Behavioral and Community Health Services at Pitt Public Health, Stephen Albert. Stephen, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, we'll find out how vibrant Pittsburgh is helping newcomers make a smoother transition to the city through home-cooked meals. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.